This class was recorded in June 2016 at Herbstock, Boston's homegrown herbal conference. The presenter is Rin Midura, and the topic is the caffeine herbs. For more information about our school and clinic, please visit our website at commonwealthherbs.com.
Okay. You guys about ready? For our really fun, exciting class on herbal relaxants.
Okay, should we? Yeah, I think that's fine. All right, so I've done this class a few different times, and, you know, just for my own students at our school, and I've done it in 2 hours, and I've done it in 3 hours, and I've done it in 4.5 hours, but I haven't done 1.5 yet. So I prepared today with some of the herbs I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to talk really fast, and if you have questions, or if I say words and they all smush together and you don't know what any of them are, then just stop me, and I'll just take a breath, and then we'll try to start over from there. Also, I promise not to spend more than half the class talking about phytochemistry, but we're kind of going to have to talk about some of it, because the thing about these plants is that they're linked by the generation or the presence of this one interesting chemical, right? And what I find really fascinating about the caffeine herbs is that you find them on a lot of different places in the world, and they're not always in the same... it's like they're not all coming from the same plant family. They don't all look the same. You know, we've got trees and creeping herbs and vines and all kinds of different things going on. So they're kind of unique in that wherever people have found them, they become very, very important culturally. And that's both been in a form of praise and reverence for those herbs, but also... sometimes people will look at what happens when people consume them, especially when they consume them in high degrees or in excess, and they've said, "Yeah, I don't know about this, right? This might be moving towards a form of intoxication, right? We might be treating these herbs as drugs rather than as, I don't know, guides or something like that." So this has happened in kind of a cyclic pattern throughout the world for various plants. So I got interested in the caffeine herbs in large part after talking to and learning from Paul Bergner. You guys familiar with him? He's an herbalist he was in Colorado, and then now he's in, Seattle?
Portland,
right? But anyway, so he's a real staunch defender of caffeine, and coffee in particular. This is like just his favorite herb, and he will defend it to the death against those who would slander caffeine. So I read some of his articles, and I was like, all right, well, what's going on here? Let's dig into this. But one of the things that he pointed out was that in the Ottoman Empire, so this is like over in Turkey, there was a period of time where there were these intense religious debates about caffeine and about coffee in particular, and about whether it should be considered an intoxicant and therefore prohibited, right, by the Quran. And so there was this sort of legalistic debate going back and forth, and some were saying, well, it's not specifically listed in the like set of things that you're not supposed to have. And over here, people were saying, yeah, well, but the spirit of the law says that you know, you shouldn't have things that are going to change your mind or your perception of the world. And in the end, it was basically the sort of like the lawyer's argument that won out, right? There was the like, well, it's not actually written there, so it's okay. Later on, they had this other idea that, well, it's more like the wine of paradise, which is described in the Quran, that will neither pain their heads nor cloud their reason, and they don't consider it an intoxicant, and the idea is that because it doesn't impair judgment, that means that it's separate from things like wine or opium or whatever else. There was a similar situation that happened in Egypt in 1511, and there were stories like this through Europe in the 1700s when coffee got introduced there. And in every case, it sort of went through a similar pattern. So there's this guy in 1924 who wrote this book called Fantastica, right? And it's sort of a survey of a lot of different psychoactive plants throughout the world and throughout history. And he says, substances which act on the brain mock at all obstacles which oppose their extension. Their attraction grows slowly, silently, but surely. Finally, even the authors of legal restrictions themselves become easy prey to the fascination of these excitants, right? And so again, you see this kind of pattern happening with caffeine herbs over and over again. So, and that same guy, you know, he was writing this book about like opium and cannabis and peyote and alcohol and whatever else. And even in his own descriptions of the caffeine plants, he sets them apart from all of these other like intoxicants or excitantia that he's writing about. He says, "We know, in fact, that man has attached himself tenaciously to the caffeine plants and daily satisfies the desire they've inspired in him. And for good reasons, an abyss separates the properties and actions of these plants from the other substances described in this work," right, the peyote and the weed and whatever else. "Consciousness is not obscured by a veil of dimness or darkness. The individual is not degraded by the destruction of his free will to animal instinct." You know, like all this very... all these facts assign a particular place to these substances, right? So this happens over and over again. There's an herbalist named Dale Pendel who's kind of made a little career of studying this part of the plant world. He writes these herbals, and he calls it the poison path, you know, and it's all of these like intense substances. And when he speaks about caffeine plants, he likes to note that coffee and the clock arrived in London in roughly the same year, right? And I've heard some other herbalists kind of repeat that claim, so I went ahead and looked it up. And it's approximately true, right? So it turns out that 1652 was the first time there was a coffee house in London, and the first clock with a minute hand was 1671. So pretty close, not exactly the same year, but it's close enough for metaphor, all right? But the idea, you know, by drawing this connection is about this concept that there was a similarity between the mentality of corporate capitalism that was being sort of developed and pushed forward at the time, and the mentality that you will experience when you start to consume a lot of caffeine. You know, let's not blame the plants for that, right? Sort of an accident of history in some ways, but I would say that the sort of expansionist, rationalist, like industrializing mentality that was at play in those times, it found an ally or found an echo in the sort of state that caffeine can bring into your life, right? One unfortunate thing that we've observed is that both that mentality in terms of how we treat the earth and its people and that way of how we get there through the use of caffeine herbs, both of those have been exacerbated and abused as time has gone on since that point, right? So, Katya is here to heckle me today and to advocate for naps and that kind of thing, and I'm not actually against any of that.
As a former abuser of caffeine.
Right. Yes. She's, well, I mean, what is it? Who preaches more loudly than the converted? Right?
Sure.
But I am going to spend some time talking about what happens when people overindulge, right? So what's like, what does caffeine excess look like? How can we identify that? And how can we be clear with our clients or with ourselves about the difference between using caffeine in a way that's appropriate or even beneficial for you versus one where it's starting to cause you some problems, right? Because there is a thread or a tendency in herbalism or alternative health to want to demonize caffeine and be like, oh, no, you got to get rid of that along with your sugar and your gluten and your alcohol and your whatever else and like be really, you're kind of like puritanical about some things, right? I do think that that goes a little too far sometimes. But if we look... I should say, so this one over here is the 21 pages of the article that accompanies this class. So you can get that from commonwealthherbs.com/herbstock. It's not posted yet, but I will do that tonight. I did finally get this in to Steph a little bit late. But it should be listed with all of the other handouts from the classes from Herbstock. So just use the password calendula2016 somewhere on the Herbstock website. And you'll be able to download everybody's notes. But this one's like 20 pages long. I have a couple pictures in there. One of them is this advertisement I found from that first coffee shop in London, right? And so they were like trying to convince people to come try this weird new drink, right? And so... in the style of the time, it's just like a wall of text, you know, and it says the virtues of the coffee drink, right? Because the idea at the time was basically like, if we can convince you that something is wonderful, then you'll be a rational actor and you'll come and do it, right? So there's not really a whole lot of sex in here, as opposed to contemporary ads for coffee. But, so there's a few really interesting things in here. The coffee, it is a simple, innocent thing, composed into a drink by being dried in an oven and ground to a powder and boiled up with spring water, about half a pint of it to be drunk, fasting an hour before and not eating an hour after, which I don't think everybody does anymore, and to be taken as hot as possibly can be endured, which will never fetch the skin off the mouth nor raise any blisters, which I would contend is not entirely accurate. interestingly, some of you might be familiar with the concept of herbal energetics, you know, categorizing herbs as hot, cool, damp, dry, that kind of thing. So that's right here in this text just for the general public, right? This is 1652, people were familiar with these terms. The author says, the quality of this drink is cold and dry, and though it be a dryer, it yet neither heats nor inflames more than hot posset. Posset being a kind of, like, grain mash mixed with alcohol drink that people would take pretty habitually at the time. What else? It quickens the spirits and makes the heart lightsome. It is good against sore eyes, and he recommends that you actually, like, hold your head over the steaming pot of coffee for your sore eyes. Good against the headache. And will stop any deflection of rheums, so in case that's a problem for you. And then towards the end he says, it will prevent drowsiness and make one fit for business, if one have occasion to watch. And therefore you are not to drink it after supper, unless you intend to be watchful, for it will hinder sleep. So anyway, I thought that was kind of...
He doesn't specify what you're going to watch. If you'd like to watch a movie, please feel free to have coffee after dinner.
Yeah, I think it's really more of a kind of a night watch sort of thing there.
I'm just asking you, was this in like newspapers or was it like on the...
I think it was a post bill.
House?
Yeah. I think it was probably a post bill. It might have been in some newspaper, but yeah, I'm not really sure on that one. But there's a link in the article, so you can follow through to a longer description of it. Okay, so let's see, where are we at? So I want to talk first about caffeine in the plants themselves, right? So whenever we look at a particular phytochemical, it's a good idea to say, well, why did the plant bother to make that, right? Lots of times plants will make antioxidants or you know, bitter compounds or whatever else, and they have their own purposes in the plant's body and in its metabolism and in its life, and then we come and we ingest them and they make something happen for us. In a lot of cases, that's going to be a similar thing, right? Many of the antioxidants you find in plants, it's the same job in the herb as it is in our body, right? To protect it from UV radiation or from inflammatory damage or from whatever else like that that would have been going on in the plant itself, right? So caffeine in plants is basically a protective mechanism, right? Some people like to call it a toxin. I don't know, I think that's kind of going too far. But it will discourage herbivores from chewing on those plants, right? So there's not a lot of, like, grazing rodents that are going to come and chew up your coffee leaves or your guarana vines or your whatever else. Right?
That's because it makes them feel terrible. And they don't want to go back and do that again.
Uh-huh. It also inhibits the growth of molds on those plants, right? And so I'll come back to this later, but when you look at ground coffee or coffee that's been, even if it's whole bean, if it's been stored for a long period of time, one of the problems that can happen is that it can grow molds and those can produce mycotoxins, and that's pretty bad. But what you find is that in general, like full caf or like undecaffeinated coffee is gonna have the least incidence of those. And then water processed decaf is going to have a little bit, and then the chemical decaf, that's sort of like the cheap common stuff, is going to have a lot more, right? And in large part because it's removed this protective agent, the caffeine itself. Okay. So we can also look at where does the compound come from, right? So in the caffeine herbs, you have this sort of base called methyl xanthine, which is a fun word to write. And then that gets converted into theobromine. And then from there, that becomes caffeine. So you guys are probably familiar with theobromine from cacao, right? Cacao is the plant in the world that has the greatest concentration of theobromine in it. That's why it's named after it, right? Because cacao is theobroma in the Latin, right? So theobromine is what you find there. But really, any plant that contains caffeine is going to have some theobromine in it. It's really just a matter of how enthusiastically does the plant continue that conversion process and take the next step and go towards caffeine, right? So all of these, for maybe some practical purposes here, they're really soluble in hot water, and this is why that's pretty much the only way you're going to find people working with these herbs, is in a hot infusion. I have found it possible, though, to make a tincture out of these plants. So this bottle is labeled stimulant, because I figured that would be as straightforward as I could get. And in here, I percolated a tincture of kola nut, guarana seed, and then some eleuthero, some fotai, and some ginger. So you're welcome to take a little bit of that. If that interests you. And if you feel like you're nodding off at any point, then go ahead, just grab some and go, right? I would say, you know, just based on my own experience, like, a full dropper from that bottle is, I don't know, I'd say like roughly 20 to 40 milligrams of caffeine. It'd be like half a cup of coffee if you take the whole dropper full. Right? Just based on my own sort of gut experience. Okay, so we can also look at how caffeine is at play in humans, right? So all of these in this family, the xanthine alkaloids, you call them, those are stimulators of the central nervous system, right? So that's going to make you jittery if you take too much, but it will also just ramp up your nervous and your mental activity if you take a more like measured and balanced amount. So they do that. They have some structural similarity to adrenaline, and I'm going to pass this page around so you guys can see what these molecules look like, but there's sort of a central hexagonal ring. In caffeine and theobromine, they have this like pentagon-shaped thing on one side, but there is some similarity to adrenaline and also to another neurotransmitter slash hormone slash communication molecule. Called adenosine, right? So that's just write it over here. You can all turn your head sideways. So adenosine is a neurotransmitter in the human brain, and the more of this collects through the course of your day, the sleepier you get, right? And so what caffeine does is it comes and it binds to the adenosine receptor, right? And it prevents adenosine from binding to that receptor and having its effect to basically inhibit or to slow down nervous activity, right? And so because that's not having its impact on your body, you remain alert and you remain wakeful for a longer period of time, okay? So that's to account for the alertificating or the wakefulness-inducing effect of your caffeine plants, right? Separate from that, caffeine will also do a few other things. It increases the activity of dopamine, which is one of your sort of feel-good brain chemicals. It basically makes its signal stronger in the system. It also increases some other stimulating substances in your nervous system, like glutamate. And it increases the levels of a thing called, cyclic adenosine monophosphate. Which, great, write that down as fast as you can. So this is basically a derivative of ATP, which you might remember from high school biology is the cell, the energy currency of the cell, right? So ATP gets derived into AMP. And this is basically a messenger molecule, and it's involved in the regulation of sugars and of fats in your body, right? So when you take caffeine, you have greater levels of that going on, and so you have it turns up the metabolism, right? And now you're burning sugar and you're burning fat more rapidly than you would have been at baseline. So that seems pretty good.
Which I think is probably a reason that there's caffeine in all the diet pills.
Yeah, that seems likely. When you consume some caffeine, the levels peak after about an hour, That is referring to like drinking a cup of coffee, though. It might be a little different if you take tincture and let it absorb right under your tongue, or if you find some other way to get it into you. And then the half-life, like the time where it takes your body to break down half of it or to metabolize half of it, is about 3 to 4 hours. But you see that number for quote-unquote healthy adults, which probably means like college-age white men, because that's who gets studied in these things most frequently, right? We do know that in a woman taking the birth control pill, the time to break down caffeine to get to its half-life extends to 5 to 10 hours. Right, so almost it could be more than twice as long, and if you're pregnant, it can be up to 9 to 11 hours. Right, so if you are in either of those categories and you find that you are having insomnia, yes, it could actually be due to that cup of coffee you had at 11 a.m. or at noon. Right, even if you're not going to bed till midnight, it could still be active in your system. Okay. So caffeine has a whole pile of other actions that it does, though, in the body. And so I'll just kind of go through these one by one here. But so it's a diuretic, right? This is a thing that we notice pretty extensively. And if you look, again, at that like 1652 advertisement, one thing he dwells on there is that in the countries where people drink a lot of coffee, they don't have gout. They don't have dropsy, which is basically like edema in the lower legs due to insufficient kidney activity, or kidney stones, right? So they even knew that, you know, however many hundred years ago that was. So the diuretic effect, it does, you know, keep fluids moving through you. It will prevent the formation of stones around like little small, you know, bits of gravel or whatever that are starting to form, and help you to get rid of your waste. So that's nice, unless you drink it too close to bedtime and then you have to get up to pee 12 times in the middle of the night. It's not as fun. Caffeine has this interesting effect on the blood vessels in the body, where for sort of like the core of your body. And the peripheral tissues, it will open them. It'll have a vasodilating effect. But at the kidney and in the brain, it has a constricting effect, right? So it can be good for some kinds of headaches because of that, right? Sometimes your headache is due to what we would call cerebral circulatory stagnation, right? And you would see the person having like a lot of excess blood or like a pulsing. It'd feel full and kind of broad rather than like sharp. And pointed. So in that case, then caffeine can be helpful. A lot of people know that already. And of course, a lot of the pain-killing over-the-counter drugs that are out there, they include caffeine in those tablets, right? In part because people are often taking those for headache, and this is usually a pretty good shot, right? Okay. There's this fancy word that people who are really into hacking their workout use called ergogenic. Which basically means that it can help you to work out harder. And that's sort of true. It's a little bit here and there. But so basically what happens is that once you get to the liver, caffeine gets converted into this other thing called paraxanthine. But the point here is that that encourages faster breakdown of fats. And that frees up fatty acids and glycerol into the bloodstream where you can use those as a fuel source if your body ever has the normal experience of using those as a fuel source, right? If you're completely dependent on sugar for all of your energy, then that might not go so well for you, right? But if you're a little bit fat adapted, then that will get you there. Also, you know, if you measure somebody's power output, like how much force they can generate in a burst of energy, that goes up when you're under the influence of caffeine. So it's fairly common for people to take a bunch of caffeine and then go and do their workout, because they will push themselves harder than they would otherwise. Okay. That might be fun. If you take it after your workout along with some carbs, then that will rapidly, it will enhance the speed of glycogen replenishment into the muscles. And so that can help with workout recovery. I'm just waiting for you to throw in something here. But now, don't take this one too far, okay? But researchers will attribute an anti-obesity effect to caffeine. Basically because it promotes the oxidation of fats and because it raises your baseline body temperature, right? That's thermogenesis, the creation of heat by metabolic activity, right? And so that has a caloric cost associated with it. And so when you're under the influence of caffeine, you're burning more calories per minute than you would be otherwise, even if you're just sitting around.
I don't know. I think I should maybe drink some coffee.
I know, right? Yeah. So we're going to come to excess in a minute, but hang on. Couple other things. As a focus aid, caffeine increases mental acuity and alertness. especially for detail work. And it delays, like, if you are normally, like, stuck at one task and you're doing it for hours on end, then eventually you sort of get, well, you get bored, subjectively, but also your nerves themselves, they sort of, like, stop being triggered so much. It's kind of the same effect that you get from how when you've been wearing clothes for a long time, you don't really feel them on your body until somebody says, hey, you're all wearing clothes right now. Isn't that weird? You can, like, feel them rubbing on you, right? Now you're doing it. But the same kind of, like, dulling through continued stimulation effect happens with any task, right? So if you're there in the factory and you're making widgets for 1,000 hours, right, then eventually you're going to lose focus, right? You're going to lose acuity. Your performance is going to decline. But if we give our workers a bunch of coffee in the break room, then they will stay focused on their tasks more often, whether that's working on widgets or filling in spreadsheets or whatever it happens to be. Yeah.
And
okay.
That's the evil.
That's the evil.
Because they all give you coffee for free.
Yeah. People revolt if you don't. There have been prison riots when they tried to take the coffee away. Yeah. Okay, so how about antidepressant in big scary quote marks? Population level studies indicate that the more caffeine a group of people drink, the less likely they are to develop major depression. It's a digestive aid because it increases stomach acid secretion.
Wait, you just gonna skip right over that?
I am, just right over that. Yeah. Are you depressed? Maybe you should. No, okay, hang on. Because in today's environment, a lot of people have this back and forth play between depression and anxiety, and not to jump ahead, but caffeine can worsen anxiety pretty pronouncedly, right? So we need to use some caution there. Okay, and then finally, caffeine itself is an antioxidant, right? And in the caffeine herbs, we're often more interested, or we get greater bang for our buck from the other compounds in there that have an antioxidant capacity, but caffeine itself does have some of this effect. Okay, so these sound really great, right? They sound really desirable. So why did my herbalist tell me that I should stop drinking 12 cups of coffee a day? Well, because 12 cups is too many, you guys. Unless you're, who was it, Voltaire, who reportedly drank 70 cups of coffee a day.
Oh, my God.
I don't know. That's kind of a lot.
Didn't Baudelaire supposedly die of a caffeine overdose? Like, he wrote that whole essay about coffee massaging the velvety interior of the stomach and, like, releasing the cavalry of creativity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. It's kind of hard to actually get an overdose. Like, you would basically need to get the equivalent of 70 cups of coffee in one sitting to have, like, an acute poisoning overdose. But, again, that's like based on an LD50 sort of measurement, so there can be variation between people. And if he had a heart condition pre-existing or something like that, then that could push you over the edge, yeah. So, all right, so let's talk about caffeine excess, right? So first of all, individual sensitivity to this substance is relative, and therefore excess is relative. Some people metabolize it a lot more rapidly than others, and for them, they're not going to have the same kind of experience as somebody else does. They might feel it come on faster, but also fade away earlier, right? So they might be able to drink some coffee at 5 o'clock and then still get to sleep by 10, right? It depends. So caffeine is basically cleared from the system in the liver. And for all of you pathophysiology nerds, right, this is happening in the cytochrome P450, specifically in the 1A2 pathway, which you might be familiar from rosemary. Rosemary is a strong stimulant of that particular pathway. St. John's wort acts on a different one, and that accounts for a lot of its drug interactions, but that's a whole different class, so don't get me started.
So if you put rosemary in your coffee, it won't last as long.
You might metabolize it faster, yeah. So there's some other things, though, that speed up the activity of this pathway. Interestingly, nicotine is one of them. And I think this might account for the sort of, like, black coffee and cigarettes habit that a lot of people develop. I meant to lead with that today, right? Because, you know, between this class and our students out there who are selling Sterling Smokes over by our table, we may be the only herb school in town that will recommend black coffee and cigarettes. For certain herb. Okay.
You heard it here.
Yes, right. So, but yeah, so somebody who smokes, they're not going to get as strong or as extended of a stimulatory effect from the caffeine. Also, another strong accelerator of that metabolism is insulin. So somebody who's diabetic or otherwise insulin resistant, they're also going to process it more rapidly. So that's worth knowing about. When somebody has a strong sensitivity to caffeine, that can be taken as an indicator of sluggish liver function, right? So if you're somebody who you're like, yeah, I don't know, you know, I drink it and then I get these jitters and then they just stay with me and my gut's all roily and it lasts a long time and then I can't sleep for, you know, many, many hours after that, then that might mean that your liver's a little bit sluggish, right? You could see, like, if that was also coming along with sensitivity to dietary fats, if you had a similar experience with alcohol where it just hit you hard and lasted a long time, if you take a Benadryl, right, and it really has a strong, like, soporific effect on you, or if you have other kinds of hormone imbalances that result from the buildup of your endogenous hormones in the system, right, like, you have really bad PMS, and your doctor tells you you have high estrogen levels or progesterone or whatever else, those could all be indicators of sluggish liver function, right? And so there, you can approach that in a couple ways. First is to provide the materials your liver needs to run its detox processes. So abundant protein, magnesium, B6, zinc, right? Those are some nutrients that help. And then, of course, we've got lots of herbs for this. Dandelion, and burdock, and blessed thistle, and like gentle liver stimulants like that. If you're not taking any pharmaceuticals, you can go with St. John's wort, right? There's lots of different ways to approach that issue. Caffeine and estrogen have this particular dance because they sort of compete for clearance. And so if there's a lot of caffeine, that might cause your estrogen levels to remain higher than they would otherwise because they're like waiting in line to get cleared out of the system, but then caffeine kind of shoulders in and cuts in place, right? So that can be an issue there. We've observed that clinically as an issue for folks with endometriosis. And we have a pretty strong track record of resolving endometriosis for people, but there's a list of eliminations that we find to be really essential for long-term resolution there. Pretty much boils down to gluten, dairy, soy, excesses of sugar, and caffeine. And we've had people who've gone through that, done that for, you know, a month or two at a time. They're feeling amazing, right? Their periods don't hurt anymore. They can have sex without pain. Everything's great. And then they go and they drink a cup of coffee and, right, it comes back, right? So if endometriosis is a problem you're dealing with, then I would advise you to avoid the caffeine herbs for at least a month and see what's going on there, okay? Okay. Oh, right, so I want to get to, because I promised to spend at least half the class on the actual herbs, but I wanted to talk about adrenaline here, right? So sometimes people will say, if you drink caffeine, then it's going to squeeze your adrenal glands and get lots of adrenaline out into the system, and it's going to give you adrenal fatigue or endocrine fatigue or chronic fatigue or whatever the appropriate term is for it these days, right? So there's some truth to that and there's some not entirely true, right? At most normal levels of consumption, basically if you're getting less than 300 milligrams of caffeine at a time, which would be like 3 cups of drip coffee, all at once. If you're getting less than that at a time, at a shot, then it's not going to directly stimulate adrenaline secretion. But it will slow down the clearance of adrenaline from your system, right? And so if you, let's say you drink some coffee and then you have a number of stressors hit you all at once, you are going to secrete a bunch of adrenaline and it is going to hang around longer because it's not going to be cleared out as fast due to the influence of caffeine there. But really what's the biggest problem for people, I think, is that rather than the caffeine being the thing that, like, destroys their adrenal function, it's the sleep debt, right? And they're using the caffeine to enable themselves to go ever further into sleep debt, right? Sleep debt is, I should be getting 8.5 hours of sleep every night, and instead I get 6, because that's the standard amount of sleep that people in America get on a weeknight, 6 hours. So if you do that long term, that will definitely screw up your endocrine system. And caffeine will enable you to keep pushing through, getting your work done, filling in your spreadsheet, making all your widgets, and ignoring the effect that's taking place there.
Well, so what I'd like to measure then is how much caffeine is in a Starbucks large cup, because that's probably more than 3 cups of drip coffee.
I don't know.
And people are definitely getting that all in one shot, plus all of the concurrent sugar that's in there.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I have some numbers for how much is in various drinks, but I don't know that I put them all in here today. But you can find those.
Yes.
Yeah. The highest I found from like a Starbucks drink was if you take what do they call it, Trenta cup. It's like the biggest thing they have. And if you fill that with drip coffee, not espresso. Espresso actually tends to have less caffeine by volume. So that I was surprised by that. I don't know about anybody else. But yeah, so if you took one of their biggest cups they've got, filled it full of drip coffee, you could get up to like, I think it was like 400 milligrams. So that would be a lot. That'd be like way too much.
My boyfriend drinks that on top of having his morning coffee too. He'll like get a Trenta to go and drink coffee there, and he still goes to sleep easily every night. I do not understand it.
Yeah. We should definitely dissect his liver for science.
Actually, I have a question.
Wait, that's the caffeine talking. Hang on.
I have a question on that topic. I know I've heard a lot that if you have ADD or ADHD, you don't respond to caffeine or stimulants in quite the same way, and it doesn't have that kind of an effect. And I'm just wondering if you know if there's any truth to that or...
I think to stimulants in general, that's definitely true. Because you can take somebody on, with one of these kind of neurological architectures, and you can give them rhodiola, you can give them caffeine, you can give them Adderall, and they don't respond to it in exactly the same way as somebody who's not set up like that, right? So, yeah, I think there is some truth to it. But, you know, one thing we gotta like, understand here, though, is that because caffeine is going to keep our stress hormones in circulation longer, it's a bad idea to take them when we're stressed, okay? Which is when most people do, right? So it's really best to avoid the use of caffeine when you're overstressed, when you're depleted, when you're worn out, right? That's the time to, like, actually get some sleep, to rest, to drink some nice, like, gentle, nourishing, restorative kind of plants, right? But that's the moment when we're most likely to turn to caffeine because we have to keep going, right? I can't miss work. I can't miss the game, whatever it is, right? And so we push through. And this is the exact opposite of what our body really wants in that time. So we're acculturated to do that, right? When you're sluggish, when you're slow, you turn to some coffee, to some, you know, like strong chai, to, God forbid, one of these energy shots, whatever, right? But this is exactly the wrong thing to do in that situation, right? Or especially when you're sick. Right, so for people who are like chronically depleted, this is not the way to go. Right? You know, eat when hungry, sleep when tired. If we would do that, then most of our problems would probably go away. Okay, so in 1898, there's this book, King's American Dispensatory. Right, so this was from the period of time when herbalism, as a like university level training and medical practice was the dominant form of healthcare in this country, right? So you've heard of the eclectics or the physiomedicalists, right? This was one of their like working texts. And they described a syndrome called caffeinism, mm-hmm. right? So they recognized that people could, you know, overshoot the mark, and what would that look like, right? So again, we want to understand what are the specifics about how these things are going to impact us when we're getting too much. So caffeinism, right? Headache, insomnia, anxiety, nervous irritability, tremors, heart palpitations, muscular weakness, and in fact fatigue as resulting from somebody getting too much caffeine or taking it too frequently. So if you look at the like modern known or recognized neurological or psychological consequences of exceeding your tolerance for caffeine, they hew really closely to that same list, right? Anxiety disorders are really strongly implicated or connected to excess caffeine. And in fact, and I know this is like a really flawed object or thing in the world, but the DSM, right, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, they do include caffeine-induced anxiety disorder in its list of things that people can have and that we can build them for. caffeine, it can precipitate a panic attack if you're already prone to those. It can heighten levels of anxiety. Paul Bergner, he cited a study that found, a direct correlation between your caffeine intake and your level of anxiety, right? So it's sort of the opposite of that epidemiological study that said, like, more caffeine, less depression. It's like more caffeine, more anxiety. So, like, pick which one you think would be more fun to have. I guess. Yeah.
Just to circle back, Starbucks says that a grande drip coffee on average contains 330 milligrams.
Okay.
And a venti is about 410.
All right. Yeah. So, yeah, watch out.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Paul had this other study where it was a small one, right? They only had like 6 people in it, but they came in, they had anxiety, and the only intervention was don't have any caffeine anymore, and 5 out of the 6 people, their anxiety went away, like entirely, okay? So again, if you have insomnia, if you have anxiety, if you have panic disorder, then this could be at play for you. And the thing to note is that like a lot of us, we sort of like, we drink our coffee or our tea or whatever, we feel a rush of energy come on, and we're like, okay, this is the caffeine effect happening, right? And then after a couple of hours, that fades away, and we're like, okay, the caffeine is gone now, right? And I'm done with it. But again, those are only the more like noticeable direct stimulation effects on the nervous system and your neurotransmitters and whatever else. But that adenosine thing, right, keeping you wakeful, that persists for a lot longer than the subjectively detectable effects of the caffeine. All right, so again, this is going to usually have a longer like time of effect on your body than you're gonna be noticing directly. Okay, so great. There's some more about this, some specifics on insomnia, and potassium depletion can also be a problem if you're drinking lots of caffeine because of the diuresis, right? You pee a whole lot more, you lose a bunch of potassium. So eat more avocados, basically, right? You can get potassium from coconuts, from prunes, from pumpkin seeds, from tomatoes, from beet greens. Don't talk to me about bananas. I have a personal vendetta against bananas. They're, first of all right, they're all clones,
yeah.
Right? They're all just the same genes over and over again.
If you've had one, you've had them all.
And if we did learn anything else from Star Wars, right, is that you can't trust clones. So, and anyway, they're not really that rich in potassium. Okay, right, get some coconut.
Dandelion leaf.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so alternatives to caffeine here, right? Usually in the U.S. anyway, this means alternatives to coffee, right? I don't really find a lot of people that are like, no, I got my black tea habit, man. I can't let it go, right? It doesn't happen. So maybe if we lived in Argentina, then like somebody's mate habit, that could be on a par, right? Yeah, I see some nodding. So with replacing coffee for people, there's a few things you got to consider for that. First is you got to titrate slowly or else they're going to get the headaches. Okay, yeah, that sucks. So draw them down a little bit. The symptoms that you get, the drowsiness, the brain fog, the irritability, and all that kind of stuff, they're coming because you've got like a rebound excess of adenosine, right? Because while you were plugging up all your adenosine receptors with caffeine, your body was like, hey, something's not right in here, I better make more, right? And so now you've got like 10 times as many adenosine receptors, and you're still plugging them all up with the caffeine, but then you take the caffeine away, and suddenly you're like flooded with a really heavy signal, right? And again, that's an inhibitory signal, right? It makes you sleepy, it makes your brain slow down, and so that's why you get those effects. Usually, it will fade away in somewhere between 2 to 10 days. But there'll be some really unpleasant days, right? If anybody's like had a caffeine habit and then gave it up for a while, you know that can really suck a whole lot. So titrate it down slowly, and you won't really have that problem. It's also a good idea to at least once in a while try a 30-day reset, just to see how you respond upon reintroduction. Right? Just like you would try with food allergies every now and again to see what's going on in your body, or at least once in your life, right? You can do this with caffeine as well and observe what happens to you when you get rid of it for like a whole month and then reintroduce it and see how that plays out for you. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
I'm sure a lot of people probably experience this. You know, if you get sick and you're like, oh no, you don't want anything, you don't want any coffee, and it's fine. Your body just assimilates and there's no problems, you're not having any withdrawals. Hmm. And I always say, oh, this is the time I should stop drinking it.
Right.
But if I'm healthy and everything's going fine and I stop drinking it, then I have withdrawals. What's happening in your body then?
When you're sick, are you sleeping more?
Cold, flu kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're not moving, definitely not going to work and things like that.
It might just be that you're, you know, if you're actually doing some good self-care like that, then you're just allowing your body to rest, and it's not as noticeable.
I'm not
sure.
Going through the withdrawal symptoms of, you know, like the headaches out there, and the, you know, unable to go to the bathroom. Just, it's just not there.
Yeah.
It's just,
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. Yeah. But it's an interesting phenomenon. Okay, so just real quick, let's say, like, some considerations we're going to have if we're going to replace... Let's focus on coffee for somebody. You've got to replace the bitter. A lot of people are unconsciously dependent on coffee for its bitter elements, right? Even if they're taking it sweetened, those are still at least coming into the body and they're having some of their effects, right? So those are primarily going to affect the digestive secretions and motility, right? How well you break down your food and how rapidly it moves through the system. So you can replace that maybe with reishi, dandelion root, centauri, whatever bitter you like. Reishi is probably the closest because it still has some of those aromatic constituents at play there, so that's nice. Many coffee drinkers are dependent on coffee for its laxative effects, and they may not notice, but their routine is wake up in the morning, drink some coffee, and then go poop. And if you get the coffee out, then that doesn't really work so well, right? Yellow Dock is a pretty good, Yellow Dock tincture specifically, is a pretty good agent to introduce if someone's having that problem. Okay, and it doesn't induce dependence either, which is good, because I don't like to leap right to, like, Cascara Sagrada or Senna or something like that, because you can make people dependent on it, and I've had clients who had been using that for a long time and couldn't poop without it anymore, and that sucks, right? It's hard to wind it back, it takes a long time, and it's obviously unpleasant during the course of that, so. You might also want to look into some cerebral circulatory stimulants, like rosemary or ginkgo, right, for the brain fog or for the... it can help sometimes with the headache that somebody gets on withdrawal. You might turn to some of your more stimulating adaptogens to try to replace that, like, I drink something and I feel more energetic, right? This might be a time you work with rhodiola, or you work with true ginseng, or you work with Eleuthero in your I mean it kind of doses, right? Barring that, and I didn't bring it, but tincture of cayenne will definitely wake you up in the morning. I failed you guys because I didn't bring it here, but usually in this point I'll pass it around, everybody take a drop, and it's great. So try that if you haven't. And then on the topic of coffee replacers, most herbalists at this point are going to say, no, you're just going to roast some chicory root or some dandelion, you're going to be fine, right? And then, you know, I've tried that with a bunch of heavy coffee drinkers, and they're like, this is ridiculous. You hate fun, you know, you're probably not even a real human anyway, I don't know. So if you're going to try a replacement blend, try chaga, right? And,
yeah.
Like, be cautious here, because chaga is crazy over-harvested right now, and, you know, having its 15 minutes of fame and being abused in ridiculous, stupid ways, like, don't put chaga in a tea bag. Okay, because it has to be boiled for it to count for anything, right? So if you're going to give somebody this as a coffee replacer, make sure they understand how to use it and how precious it is, okay? But I'll say, of the herbs that I'm aware of, that one probably gets you the closest to the flavor of coffee, right? What we actually do, and this is where Katia gets her coffee every day, is we'll take a couple of tablespoons of decaf coffee and put that into a decoction blend with maybe some gentle adaptogens, maybe a little Codonopsis, maybe a little spikenard, or whatever you're into. Also put some liver-supportive herbs into there. And the flavor of the coffee is going to overwhelm all of the other stuff, right? And then people will be a lot more willing to take that. Now, if they have a super strong sensitivity to caffeine, yeah, there still is some leftover in decaf coffee, but... it's fairly small, and for most people, this is going to be sufficient to help them step away.
I'm sorry, I just missed the last thing you said. So it was decaffeinated coffee, gentle adaptogens, and...
it's just some, like, mild liver stimulants.
Oh, mild liver stimulants, thank you.
Yeah, you know, just dandelion, burdock, whatever.
And so is that, like, a daily thing, or is that to wean you off of coffee?
It's a daily thing.
Cool.
Yeah, so right now the recipe is, for anybody who really wants it, roughly equal parts. Codonopsis, Angelica Archangelica, Calamus,
what?
Calamus.
Okay.
Ashwagandha gets a double part. Spikenard. Dan Spikenard, Dandelion, Root, Burdock Root, Pleurisy Root. Because I'm an herbalist. Reishi. And if I'm really having a rough time, but then I put the chaga in. But I save the chaga for when I'm having a really rough time.
Yeah.
Oh, and Solomon seal. The very first one I said, Codenopsis maybe? Yeah? And then equal parts of
your coffee.
The coffee is like maybe 1.5 tablespoons of the Froofy Swiss water, shade grown, all the kids went to school coffee, you know.
All the kids went to school?
Yeah. No child labor and all that stuff.
Oh, right, right.
Can I ask why you add the Solomon seal on the Floristy route?
Yes, you can. Solomon seal is really excellent for emotional flexibility and also joint stuff, and I am 42, so there are some joint things. But really what it's doing in there is the emotional flexibility. Karen Sanders teaches a Native American way to work with Solomon seal is when you can't be true to yourself. And there's lots of reasons that you can't be true to yourself. Maybe what you're not being true to is you need to go to bed 2 hours earlier last night. Or maybe you're not being true to yourself because you just can't quit this job that you hate. I mean, it doesn't have to just be like you're lying to yourself about whatever, sometimes it's circumstance. The pleurisy is because I have MS, and I really like pleurisy for helping with spastic bladder stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so,
yes.
So, are you recommending to cut coffee out completely or just like change the way that you...
It depends entirely on the person's individual sensitivity and the kind of problems that they're experiencing.
And I guess the other question I would have, do you think it matters like the dosage that you take at once? Like for instance, if we're talking about the Starbucks cups versus like I know places outside the US people will have like an espresso after dinner,
right.
But it'll be such a small amount.
Yeah.
And they might have that espresso after every meal.
Right.
But, and it might even be the same thing as having one Starbucks once, like, in the morning. Would you
right.
think that matters, or?
I think it matters a lot, you know? And in a lot of those countries, you know, it's after a meal that's also quite fatty, you know? And it's going to aid in the digestion of that, so it makes a lot more sense there than
okay.
if it was after a meal of, like, what's the carbiest meal you can think of? I don't know, like, rice and lentils and pasta noodles, because why not, right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a good idea after that, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I definitely think that makes a huge difference.
I have a question. What about blending coffee with coconut oil or bulletproof
coffee?
Oh,
right, yeah, so the bulletproof coffee thing, right, or butter or whatever else. Yeah, that's fine. You know, the bitter principles in there, they're gonna enhance your absorption of those fats. So that's cool. I don't think it's going to like make you live forever or whatever else. But, I mean, if you need a way to get a bunch of fat or medium chain triglycerides or whatever into your body, then sure, why not? I think that's fine. And then one back there, and then I'm going to move on.
I've seen coffee bitters for like cocktail making.
Yes.
You said that the, you're getting to it?
No, but I'm just going to pass around. This is a coffee pecan bitters that I made. Kind of for cocktail, but also for my taste of coffee today.
Mm-hmm.
So you can enjoy that.
So
what's
my
the
question was, when you said that, or when coffee doesn't, or caffeine doesn't extract into alcohol. Is just the bitter, or just the bitter constituents?
Caffeine does extract into the like. If I make, so the one I passed around earlier, you know, that was like a 75% alcohol. It was like a 151 rum or something, and I do get a noticeable caffeine effect from there. I wonder though if I made it in 25% alcohol. So then that's going to be 75% water. If that would get me a better extraction of the caffeine specifically, right? And I'm not entirely sure, but I will say if I was to take my tea leaves or whatever and infuse them into olive oil, I wouldn't expect to really get caffeine coming out that way. Yeah.
Is this made from 20% alcohol and the coffee Arabica?
That one right there was in a It's a mix of things. So that started as a maceration in plain vodka, so that would have been 40%. And then I mixed it, it mixed with a decoction of the marc after the tincture was finished macerating. So the finished alcohol tincture in there is probably just like
20%. Okay, but you add water later on? Or?
It had water in it. Okay, so I'm going to skip over the section in here where I would talk about the other interesting constituents in here individually. I'm going to kind of fold them in as we go through the herbs that they're kind of most prevalent in. But do read that part because it's very fascinating and I like it all. So let's.
You can get all 22 pages at commonwealthherbs.com/herbstock.
Yes. Okay, so let's talk about the caffeine plant. So I passed around the coffee pecan bitters, and let's just start with coffee. And one thing I wanted to kind of lead with, because we like to talk about the energetics of our herbs when we do materia medica study, are they heating, cooling, are they drying, are they moistening, do they cause tension, or do they cause laxity, right? So the caffeine plants are universally going to be drying because they're so diuretic, right? You pee out all of your water, you end up drier than you were to begin with, okay? They're also universally, or pretty close to universally, tonifying, right? Tightening to the tissues that they come into contact with or that they have a strong impact on in the body, right? Remember that the caffeine itself is going to make a tonifying effect in your cerebral vasculature and at your kidneys, but also in many of the caffeine plants, you're going to have a pretty strong astringent taste or impression from them, right? And that's an indicator of a tonifying effect, tightening. Whether these herbs should be categorized as warming or cooling is a thing that herbalists just can't make up their minds about throughout the course of the ages, right? So I told you from the 1652 advertisement there, the person writing that categorized it as a cooling herb. Avicenna, who you might have heard of, sort of like a founder of Persian medicine, Unani Tib, he considered coffee to be warming in the first degree, but he noted that a lot of other people considered it to be cooling. I would say that in today's terms, we recognize in coffee that it has both a stimulant effect, which we would generally categorize as being heating, right? But it also has anti-inflammatory actions to it, and we would call those cooling. And I think that it's really a matter of which one of those you choose to emphasize that's going to shape your assessment of the plant, okay?
It's inflammatory.
Say no?
It is anti-inflammatory.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, all of the caffeine herbs have a lot of anti-inflammatory agents. So. About coffee, there's Caffea arabica, and there's Caffea robusta as well. Most of the coffee that you've had, forgive my terrible handwriting, most of the coffee that you've had has been arabica. The robusta is like 20% of the coffee in like the world's marketplace, but a lot of that is just... it's just expended in Africa, where it's mostly grown, right? Also, Bio reports Robusta has greater caffeine content, but it has less of the aromatic constituents that you find in the Arabica that kind of give it those like heady scents and aroma values that you are often going to prize. So, coffee is in the Rubiaceae family, so this is the coffee family or the bedstraw family, and this is why occasionally people will say, oh, you want a coffee replacer? Go and get cleavers and harvest the seeds, and then after 20 years, you'll have enough to make a cup of coffee and it'll be fine, right? Because they're so tiny, right? But other herbs in this family include cinchona, which is a really intense bitter, and cat's claw, and I imagine there's probably some herbs that don't start with C, but I didn't bother to look, because Sesame Street taught me that three is enough. Okay, so native to Ethiopia, in this country, people will often just chew on the beans or pound them up and mix them with butter and make a little cake out of it, which sounds kind of good. And legend has it that coffee came to people when a goat herd observed his goats eating the leaves and berries of a particular plant and then frolicking their way through the fields. And he said, well, that seems like a good idea. Let's try it. So origin stories are always good to get your hands on.
Have you heard the one about like somebody bringing coffee beans to this like old medicine man, and the medicine man was like, oh no, like somebody somebody brought them to them and was like, this is so medicinal, and we'll do this and this. And the guy's like, no, and he throws them in the fire. And then they smell
them. And then
roast
they roast them.
Like,
here we go. Now we get something. No, that's a good one, yeah. So we use the seeds, or we can call them beans if we want, but they're really the seeds there. And in some places, they use the leaves as well, and they just infuse them like tea. From what I haven't done this because I don't have a coffee plant, but from what I understand, it's somewhere in flavor between coffee and tea. So that sounds kind of fun. So if you ever get the chance, then please bring me some. That would be great. We'll try that together. So in coffee, we have caffeine, and by dry weight of the beans, it's like 1 to 3%. We also have chlorogenic acid and caffeic acid. So these, so chlorogenic acid and caffeic acid, these are antioxidants, anti-inflammatory, and anti-diabetic, which is to say that they improve blood sugar regulation in the body. This is probably the reason why you find this inverse relationship between coffee consumption and the rate of diabetes in like population-level studies, epidemiological studies, right? So you take 100,000 people and you ask them how much coffee do you drink, and you like track some health markers and see how many of them become diabetic over the course of their lives, and it like plummets the more coffee you drink, up to like 6 cups a day or something like that. So that's pretty exciting. Chlorogenic acid has sometimes been studied as a like, can we just give that to people? It doesn't always work very well. A lot of it kind of gets broken down if you deliver it alone. But when you take it together with the other things that are in coffee, it tends to have a more pronounced effect. So that's kind of fun. It slows down your absorption of sugar. It lowers your blood sugar levels if you're already diabetic. It decreases the liver's output of sugar. And it also, the chlorogenic acid here, it strengthens the beta cells in the pancreas. Those are the ones that actually make your insulin for you. So by and large, if somebody is insulin resistant or diabetic or something like that, and they can drink some black, preferably, coffee, then that can actually be really beneficial for them. Right? And so again, when people come in and we're trying to like say, all right, how can we make you a healthier person? How can we clean up your act, whatever? Then taking coffee away isn't really my first line of action. Right? Especially if they had some metabolic dysregulation or if their diet was otherwise poor. Right? This might be helping to keep things in check. So,
what did you say, chlorogenic acid, what was the other?
Caffeic acid.
And
caffeic acid is basically just a pretty fancy antioxidant, right? Caffeic acid, you actually also find it in cacao, you find it in red sage, you even find some in echinacea. And in echinacea, echinacea will actually convert it to another level, and it will make this thing called CAPE, or caffeic acid phenethyl ester, which might account for some of the immunostimulating effects of echinacea. I really only say this because I'm interested in, like, just like we're interested in plant families, you can get interested in chemical families, right? So here you have something that starts with cinnamic acid, and then it becomes chlorogenic acid, and caffeic, and then CAPE, and kind of like moves down, and you can see the way that impacts the medicine or the effect of the herb that it lives in. That's kind of cool. Okay. Let's see. Oh yeah, the other thing that chlorogenic acid does is gonna speed up your absorption of caffeine and slow down your elimination of it. And I think this accounts for why coffee is qualitatively different from your other caffeine plants. Right, because this isn't really found in most of the other ones, right? There's like a touch of it in mate. You find it in a few other plants here and there, but chlorogenic acid is like strongest in coffee, and so that's going to make it hit you faster and stay with you longer, right? So I know plenty of people who are like, yeah, coffee, man, I don't know, I can't handle that, but they can drink tea or they can drink mate or whatever else, and they don't have those issues. So coffee is a circulatory nervous stimulant, it gets your bile flowing, it's a diuretic, protects the heart, antioxidant, hypoglycemic, a bronchodilator, right, opens up your lungs, help you breathe more deeply. So, You could make a case for coffee as an alterative herb, right? Because it warms up the core of the body. It helps to resolve what you would classify as liver stagnation, right? So your liver's not really working at full tilt, right? In coffee, it's because you have both the caffeine, but also, I think even more important here, is those bitter principles, right? So there's kawayol and cafestol and these other things, and they're really strongly bitter, and they really make that bile flow, right? Out of the liver to the gallbladder, from there to the intestines, and that kind of keeps that system moving, right? So it's good for, like, the damp heat pattern. Or in the Western tradition, you find the idea of bad blood, right? A lot of that comes down to poor function of your innate filtration and cleansing mechanisms, right? The liver, the kidneys, things like that. Coffee is going to speed up activity there, so it can help to resolve some of that stagnation.
The question about effect coffee in enema.
Yeah.
Enema coffee.
Boy, I don't know, man. not something I really have any experience with. I mean, like, you are going to absorb it pretty rapidly right there, and you're going to get a really strong stimulation on the viscera. So, I mean, a lot of people, from what I understand, will take the coffee enema as part of, like, a cleansing program,
yeah.
And I believe that it will definitely empty you.
What?
Like, empty you. It just, but I'm not convinced that it's a great idea, and I definitely don't think it's going to cure anybody's cancer. Because you see these claims, you know?
If you're interested in detox and the sorts of things that would make you say the words coffee enema, then starting in mid-July, Rin is teaching a 5-part webinar series on the elements of detoxification. I like to call it the skinny on detox. And so you can check that out on our website.
Because there is everywhere where you open alternatives, coffee enema, coffee enema.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. People are really into it, but I can't quite get there. Yeah. So, you know, I mentioned Paul Bergner at the beginning here as like a defender of coffee for the ages, right? And he's got this quote, cup for cup in epidemiological trials, the more you drink, the longer you live, the fewer heart attacks you have, the less diabetes you have, up to about 6 cups a day. This is found in every population studied on 3 different continents. So, I mean, yeah, there is pretty solid evidence for this kind of thing.
Maybe there's evidence that Paul really likes coffee.
Let's say that for a lot of people running around in the U.S. right now, coffee is the richest source of antioxidants in their diet, right? Like if they're eating food from 7-Eleven and McDonald's, right, the coffee is actually providing them with some real phytonutrients, you know? And I would worry about the McDonald's first, you know? Yeah. Okay, you might have heard somewhere out there that coffee will raise cholesterol levels, and that's technically true. However, there's some caveats here. You'll really tremendously reduce that effect if you filter your coffee through paper, like most people are doing, right? Because that will sort of bind up the principles that are causing that effect to take place. But those are, the other side of it is that those are also the bitter principles, and some of them are still going to come through, but it's going to be reduced. So like traditionally, coffee would have been boiled, and if you just boil your coffee or your grounds or whatever, then you are going to have a raising effect on your cholesterol levels. That's not always a bad thing, as like people are finally catching on that cholesterol is not always the enemy and all of that kind of thing, but it is notable. Okay, when we talked about diabetes, a couple of considerations about coffee. You have got to differentiate coffee from coffee-based beverages or coffee-flavored sugar bombs or whatever else, right? Like if we go back to Starbucks, if I go in and I get like a mocha frappa chocolatino thing, then I'm not drinking coffee anymore, right? I'm drinking sugar that tastes like coffee, and yeah, it has some of the beneficial compounds in there, but they're going to be overwhelmed on the physiological level by all of that sugar and all of that dairy, you know, especially if I have a dairy sensitivity that I'm not aware of yet, right? It's going to knock down all the benefits that I would have been getting and take them away from me. So I prefer to take my coffee black, and for me, also pretty rarely. Right? And then conventional versus organic. I imagine in this room most of you are already like keen on organic. And there's plenty of great reasons for that. First of all, being that coffee is one of the most heavily sprayed conventional crops, they also need to use a pile of chemical fertilizers to get it to grow, because it tends to acidify and deplete the soils that it's grown in. So, you know, traditionally it would be shade grown, and that would involve basically at least a subset of the intact forest ecosystem, right? Because you need tall trees for the shade and some other ground herbs around there. And that kind of thing. So nowadays they might just have like some shade nets over it and just like rows and rows of coffee plants. Easier to harvest, easier to make a profit from, but much worse for the soil, and it involves a lot more, you know, petrochemical inputs. So that's not very cool. And then of course there's the social aspects as well, right? So a lot of places people are paid like less than whatever would be considered minimum wage. There can be really poor child labor laws in a lot of these areas. So organic and fair trade, or some other, you know, equal exchange, or some other like third-party certification that you trust and that you've looked into, I consider that to be essential when you're going to buy coffee. Right? I kind of mentioned decaffeination offhand a little earlier. Remember that the chemical decaf is more likely to grow mycotoxins on it. That's bad stuff. And
plus, it's more likely to be decaffeinated.
Well, yeah, right? And, you know, like, you'll read something and it'll be like, oh, but 85% of those are degraded during the roasting process. I'm like, I didn't want 15% of whatever on me. You're like, I don't actually want that. So, so organic is better there, too. Okay.
Do you consider it contraindicated for people who have heart conditions?
It depends on the condition. If they have palpitations, then yeah. If they, if we call it a heart condition, but really it's just like they have some development of atherosclerosis or some other oxidative damage, then I don't think it's necessarily contraindicated there. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, the question also is the method of brewing, so the pressing coffee, dripping coffee, espresso coffee, or boiling coffee, which method gives more antioxidants? The coffee?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Couldn't tell. So let's talk about tea. And I don't have a sampler thing for tea for you guys today, but I'm sure that there's somebody out in the market with a nice chai blend or a... Actually, at our table, one of our students made a nice chai bitters. It's really tasty. She did a good job of like balancing the heat and the vanilla and the sweet notes in there. So check that out. Anyway, tea. Camellia sinensis. So tea can be a little bit bitter, it can be earthy, it can have some aromatic scents to it, and often tea is going to be astringent. One of the reasons that tea gets astringent and that it becomes more so the longer you steep it is because of these flavonoids that are present in there. We call them catechins, which is fun to say, right? But so a catechin is a kind of antioxidant. In the plants, again, these are messengers or else protectors. They protect against UV damage, against predation, against infection by little microbes, whatever else. In our bodies, the catechins and the there's another like derivative of them, they're antioxidants. They're anti-inflammatory. Somebody gets famous calling them an anti-aging agent, you know, right? So that's fun. They also help to prevent the development of cancer as well. And so you might have heard the acronym EGCG in reference to green tea studies, right? So that is epigallocatechin-gallate, right? So you go catechin to epigallocatechin to epigallocatechin-gallate. And I say these names because they get longer, right? And that's the actual molecule growing, right? And so the longer that molecule is, the more astringent it becomes, right? If you keep going, you cross over into this other thing called oligomeric proanthocyanidin. It's OPC, right? And so those are really astringent. And then you keep going and you develop tannins. And you could actually like tan leather with it, right? So in tea, you have the catechins and the OPCs. And that's why like it takes more time for the bigger ones to come out of the leaf matter into your water. And that's why like usually a tea aficionado is going to be like, okay, steep this tea for exactly 1 minute and 2 seconds. Right, or whatever it is, right, and it's going to give you the nice like balanced flavor that's not going to be too. They'll often say too bitter, but what they really mean is astringent, right? That feeling of right where it tightens up all the taste buds on your tongue, right? So if you want to like stop that astringency from developing, then you cut out the infusion process a little bit early. But on the other hand, some of those astringent molecules are pretty potent in terms of antioxidant effects or helping to lower blood sugar levels, to reduce hypertension, and to have some other good stuff going on for you. So those are most famously found in tea. You do find them in some of the other herbs, right? You might find them in a little bit in mate or in the hollies that we're going to talk about towards the end. I have till 12:30.
Yes.
Is that it? Oh, man. Okay. Let's see. What would I most want to say here? Right. So let's talk about theanine, right? So L-theanine. This is a really interesting constituent that's pretty much only found in tea, as well as the hollies again, the huayusa, and I think there's some in the yaupon, just from my own experience of it, but I'll come to that in a minute. But theanine is found in tea leaves and huayusa and a few others, and this one, it crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is always going to make exciting things happen, right? It primes the response of some immune cells that are in your lymph. Helps you to have better surveillance against microbes and cancer cells as well. But people are mostly interested in L-theanine because of its effects on your nerves and your mentality, right? This is an anxiolytic. It calms down anxiety, but it's not sedating. It helps you to be settled. It actually affects both physiological and psychological markers for stress. Like, it will lower high blood pressure, and it will also calm down panic or anxiety or worry. And it does seem to also upregulate some of the neurotransmitters in your brain, including dopamine and GABA, which you might have heard of. It's like gamma-aminobutyric acid or something like that. But so that's another like calming or like relaxing, focusing agent, right? So tea has a whole bunch of theanine in it, and because that comes together with the caffeine, right? The caffeine is there to like sort of stimulate the nervous system and get you like alert and awake and ready to go. The theanine is there to like calm you down and keep you from getting too worried and anxious. The effect of drinking tea is a lot more balanced and a lot less prone to like overextension than it is when you get it from caffeine or from coffee or from guarana or whatever else, right? So I think this is why a lot of people will really prefer to drink green or black tea, and they feel pretty good, and they can do focus tasks, and they can stay on point, but they don't get that like jitteriness that comes with it. Right? So that's pretty nice.
But according to research, the black tea has highest amount of aluminium, which is concentrated in the brain.
Right. Yeah. So the downside of the catechins and the OPCs here is that they do increase the uptake of metal ions, and that includes whatever was in the soil and then whatever was in the plant. So make sure that the tea you drink does not come from somewhere with lots of lead in the soil. Okay? Because it'll get into your body more rapidly. Green, black, and white tea, they all come from the same plant. You guys probably knew that already because you've got some herbalism going on. It's basically a fermentation process that you start with green tea and you ferment that, and then it becomes black tea, right? Oolong tea, by the way, is like somewhere in the middle. It's like halfway. They call it fermentation. It's really an oxidation process. It's the same chemical that makes your apples turn brown when you slice them and leave them on the counter. Same thing. I have a thing in here about caffeine levels in tea. The short of it is that if it was the same plant and I took some and I crossed it to be white tea, which is a particular drying process, and I left some just normal drying and made it green, and I oxidized some and made it black, then actually the white tea would have the highest caffeine content, right? Which is the opposite of what a lot of us expect. Like, I know a lot of people who are like, oh, white tea, that'll have less, right? But it's actually, if it's from the same plant, it should be higher. Now, there's a lot of variety and a much greater impact on caffeine levels depending on where the plant was grown and the conditions it was grown in. And because we most often use like Indian Assam tea to make our blacks and use some of the like Chinese like high altitude to make our greens and whites, functionally, like if you go to the store and you're looking at the different ones, then it's usually going to be black tea with the highest content and then white in the middle and then green having the lower. right? Just for in case that interests you. Okay. If you're going to get decaf tea, you want a carbon dioxide supercritical decaffeination process for this one. They sometimes do water extract decaf or chemical decaf, but those are both crappy, and they also make you lose like 80% of the antioxidant polyphenols that you want. So that sucks. Don't do that.
The reason why black tea has more caffeine because you infuse it longer, whereas the white teas, you're not infusing it as long, so the caffeine isn't extracted.
Yeah, but this is also true by weight.
Weight.
You know, by finished, but dry weighted from the plant. Yeah. And then sometimes people have heard that if you take your tea and you like do a pre-infusion for like 30 seconds first, and then take that tea bag out and then make your actual cup of tea with it, that it'll be decaf. No, that's just not true. And there's lots of research actually behind that, and I've got a link to it in my PDF. So yeah. Okay, so let's talk about cacao, and I have some cacao nibs for you guys. So cacao nibs are the dried parts of the seeds. So you have this like big fruit, and they take that and they separate it out, and you get over here, you take the cocoa butter, right? And then over here you take the seeds and you dry them and you make the cacao nibs, and then you powder that, and then you mix them back together with the cocoa butter, and ta-da, chocolate. Hooray, right? So that's where that goes. Cacao is a flavor, right, kind of bitter, especially when you get the raw nibs like this. Earthy, they have some aromatics to them. I really recommend trying sometime, make a decoction of cacao nibs. You'll see the oils exude from them and float on the surface, right, and you'll get a really nice, like, aromatic smell. So cacao, it's theobroma. Cacao, right? And theobroma, of course, is food of the gods. So that's just wonderful. Cacao is in the mallow family, you guys. It's in the same family as marshmallow and hibiscus. This is ridiculous. So, you know, so the names we have for it, right, they come from Mesoamerican languages. Certainly the ancient Mayans were using this a long, long time ago. I guess this is the time to talk about theobromine. And theophylline. So these are going to have diuretic effects. They're going to be central nervous system stimulants. They're very similar, of course, to caffeine because they are its precursor, right? Remember that. And so, like I said, you'll find theobromine in just about everybody. this is a cardiac stimulant, but a smooth muscle relaxant, which is kind of interesting. Right, so it'll make your heartbeat a little faster, but it will relax some tension in you. And hey, don't people think of chocolate as kind of a aphrodisiac? Doesn't that kind of make sense? Yeah, my heart pounding a little bit, relaxed a little bit. Okay, do that. Yeah. Theobromine, by the way, is also the thing that makes chocolate toxic to dogs. And that's why your chocolate dog treats use carob instead, right? Because that doesn't have any. And then there's a little bit of theophylline in cacao as well. Theophylline, you also find it in tea and a few others. And that one is a pretty pronounced bronchodilator, right? It opens up your lungs. In fact, in pharmacy, they'll give people isolated theophylline like for asthma attacks and that kind of thing, right? Or for just an asthmatic, like constricted lung condition. So let's see here. You know, you gotta differentiate cacao and chocolate to some extent, especially, you know, it depends on the maker. I see a lot of good chocolate running around out here. Of course, there's Apothecar's chocolate right upstairs. It's like honey sweetened and super fantastic, and fair trade and everything else. Those are great people. But, you know, the added sugar in the milk in like Hershey's or whatever, that's, again, it's going to take away a lot of the benefit that you would be getting from cacao itself, right? Or from a good, like, you know, 70 or 90% dark chocolate, that kind of thing. Sometimes when people have cravings for chocolate, it's the body trying to get you to consume some magnesium. Because of the foods that we eat, cacao or chocolate itself is fairly high in magnesium, kind of comparable to like pumpkin seeds. So it's pretty good. And you know, when we get cravings for things, that's your body speaking to you through an image. and like saying, well, when was the last time I had any of that nutrient come through here? Okay, well, there was someone, we ate chocolate. Okay, let's get a chocolate craving going, right? So if that plagues you, then try a magnesium supplement for a while, and also make sure your chocolate's really dark, because that's going to have more of that mineral in it, okay? One thing you should definitely do is you should take some cacao nibs and one cayenne pepper and put that into a bottle of wine and a nice bold red wine like a Carmenere, Malbec or something, and let that steep for a couple of weeks and then drink that with somebody you really like. Yes.
What did you say? Was it
cayenne pepper? What?
Yeah, just one. One dried cayenne pepper, like two or three tablespoons of cacao nibs, you'll be all set.
And what to do with this cayenne pepper? Can you repeat?
You're
going to
put it in a bottle of wine.
Oh, in the bottle of wine.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I only have a few minutes, so I'm just going to kind of hit the highlights here, right? So kola nut, I have some powder here I'll pass around. Yes, this was actually used to flavor Coca-Cola, along with cocaine. With coca leaves, which I have in them. It was fine. Cola, you know, a can of Coke is usually going to have like 35 milligrams of caffeine, which feels kind of quaint now. You know, whereas like Red Bull or 5-Hour Energy or whatever is like 100 or 200 milligrams of the shot, so... this comes from West Africa. We had a pharmacy student come through who told me about a naming ritual that they do, and it seems to be a Yoruba thing, where they would have like representatives of the major flavors, and they would bring them during the naming day for the new baby, and the adults and everybody would sample them and taste them and kind of like go through it as a ritual process. So they would use the kola nut to represent the bitter in life. So cola, you know, it has a pretty strong bitter flavor to it. I don't really see a lot of people using kola nuts in Western herbal practice these days, except as a component in zumbals, right, where you take your nut butter and you mix it together and you have one of those. I have for you guys, this is a honey paste made with kola, guarana, cacao, and a little bit of ginger. You can grab a toothpick and scoop some out of there. But that has a pretty good zoom to it. Well.
Where do you get your cacaos from? They're really good.
I got these ones from Mountain Rose.
Okay.
I also like, in the shops, I like Theo. In a little square box. Those are pretty good. Yeah.
Taza here in Somerville also sells them.
Oh, right on. Yeah, yeah. For sure.
Yeah,
Taza. Taza, yeah. Okay, guarana. And I say it that way because I got yelled at by a friend from South America. It's not guarana, it's guarana. Okay, all right, so now you all know. And no Chileans will assault you. I hope. So guarana, it's kind of bitter, kind of astringent. It's in the same family as maple trees, which I think is kind of neat. Comes from the Arizon, from Paraguay. And we use the seeds there. Guarana is kind of a pure bearer of caffeine. It doesn't have a whole lot of these other, like, high-potency constituents at play there. It has a little bit of theophylline, it has minor amounts of theobromine, a little bit of catechins in there, some antioxidants, but it's mostly a caffeine delivery system. And the eclectics and physiomedicalists, they would write about guarana for headaches, but they were really particular about it, right? If someone's face is red, if their migraine comes after indigestion, this is not the remedy for them. It's only for when there's that headache due to poor circulation up to the head, right? So a pale face kind of a thing. All right, and then what I really wanted to get to was the caffeine hollies, right? So most of you are probably familiar with yerba mate, right? So that's Ilex paraguayensis. But then there's two others, right? So you might have seen these guys around town. I'm not advertising this particular brand, but this is the one you're going to see mostly. This is a huayusa tea, right? It's Ilex huayusa. That's spelled with a G. I'll write it down later. That's in the same family. And then it turns out that we do, in fact, have a native North American caffeine plant. It's called yalpon, or Ilex vomitoria. I'll pass this around. You guys can open that and smell. So the thing about the Ilex vomitoria, the yalpon holly, it doesn't actually make you vomit. It was used in a native ceremony making this concoction called the black drink, right? And that had a whole bunch of other herbs in there, some of which are emetics. And so people would take this in great quantity, and they would vomit and purify themselves and then have a dance, and that was great, right? But so like Ilex vomitoria there, the Yaupon holly, it kind of got a bad name by association. But all of these are quite similar. They have fair amounts of caffeine, you know, mate maybe up to 2%, guayusa up to 3%. They all have some theobromine in there. Mate has a fair amount of chlorogenic acid, you know, that's the anti-diabetic constituent from coffee. They have some good mineral content in there as well. And then the other thing is that at least guayusa has been determined to have some theanine in it. Right, remember that was one we only otherwise found in tea. And it's real interesting because it gives you that stimulation, but also that calm and like centered and focused kind of thing. I have observed that when I've used guayusa tea. I think that's present. And this Yaupon, I ordered a bunch like a week ago. They just came in a couple days ago, so I've been drinking a lot of Yaupon for the past couple days, and I have some here in this thermos for you guys. If we can pass around the thermos and the cups, you're welcome to take some. I do find that it gives a similar kind of effect, right? It's a bit of a stimulant. It's obviously a caffeine plant, but it gives you a decent amount of focus as well at the same time. So the Yaupon, it grows in like East Texas, along over to Florida and areas like that, maybe a little bit further north by a state or two. And you know, again, mate that comes from along Paraguay, I think, and guayusa is from the Amazon, right? So, all right, stay with me. We get to go like two more minutes, okay? So on all these, we're using the leaves. There's a lot of focus on the circulatory and respiratory system, the nervous system in here. There was this big study done in either Chile or Argentina, but they were studying people who drank a lot of mate, right? Like their group, like, in order to qualify as a mate drinker, you had to be like more than 1 liter of it a day.
Oh God.
Right? Which isn't hard to find in Argentina, but okay. But so what they found actually was that they had improved bone density compared to the people who didn't drink it, right? And I think part of that's from the mineral content of the herb, but part of it might also just been from the effects of the caffeine or maybe the theanine in the system, because similar results have been found for tea as well, right? So people worried about osteoporosis or brittle bones or whatever else, then maybe having a little, I'm not saying you should drink a liter of mate a day, but you know, something could help. Mate has also been noted to be a proven antioxidant, protects against DNA damage, which, you know, read cancer there, right? A vasodilator, inhibits atherosclerosis, improves blood sugar, glucose tolerance, anti-inflammatory. And then there's been a lot of study about mate in particular for people trying to lose weight, right? Because of the thermogenesis and the creation of heat from the body. All right, so I know that last part was kind of a rush, but like, this is it, you guys. It's this 8 plants, right? So coffee, cacao, tea, cola, guarana, and then the 3 hollies, right? The mate, guayusa, and yaupon. And that's it, right? There might be some other plants out in the world that have like a little touch of caffeine here and there, but in terms of like substantial content that's going to give you a buzz, this is everything, okay? And I find that really fascinating, again, because they're from these places around the world. They're far distributed. They're in different plant families, right? We had a mallow, we had a maple family, we had the bedstraw family, and then the hollies, right? So it's just interesting that this emerges and it becomes like so important to humans, right? That, you know, all of these now, maybe not the Yaupon, but all the others, they're like on different continents now than where they originated because of trade. And there's these crazy stories about people like hiding caffeine berries in their wife's bodice or whatever to like get them through customs and like like all that kind of thing, right? So you know, we live in an age when we have access to any of these whenever we want, but this is the kind of thing that you would go on a pilgrimage to find, right? This is like these elixirs of immortality that people would keep off to the side and that kind of thing. So I'm waiting for you to jump in and be like, sleep, go to bed, drink some chamomile.
It's a lot easier than smuggling coffee beans in your wife's bodice. Just take a fucking nap.
Yeah. One last thing I want to leave you with. What I'm drinking here today, and I really strongly recommend this, is you take one of your caffeine hollies, right, your mate or your guayusa or whatever, and put it together with this plant, Gynostemma. Some people call it jiaogulan, right? But the two of those together, Gynostemma is considered an adaptogen, but it's like a restorative, soothing, like yin tonic or like moistening, rebuilding kind of an adaptogen rather than like a light your fire and set you running kind of thing. But it definitely helps for like people who are overstressed and overworked. So like if somebody's going to take a caffeine plant and they're in one of those states I talked about where it's better avoided, like you're overstressed, you're underslept, you're whatever else, then take some Gynostemma, mix it together with one of your caffeinated hollies, equal parts, and I find that that gives a much more balanced like curve to your energy, right? It'll come on pretty soon, but then it'll stay with you, and there's no like sharp drop-off. It just sort of like fades out gently. So I rely on that when it's, say, the weekend of an herb conference, and I'm going to be staying up late and trying to get a lot done. That helps me out a lot, so... okay, we're a little over time, but it's lunchtime, right? Do I have 2 minutes for questions? Yeah? Anybody?
Someone asked me recently why burnout was giving that kind of like a jittery feeling of coffee.
Yeah.
Do you know why that might be?
Because of the caffeine?
So you were saying like the acid that was in coffee, does Guarana have the same?
Does Guarana have the, I don't know. You know, like I said before, Guarana's kind of pure in its delivery of coffee compared to a lot of these other plants. And it might just be that it's got a lot higher content by weight. You know, like if I was to use a tablespoon of coffee grounds and a tablespoon of, like, even just cut and sifted dried Guarana leaf, it'd be way more caffeine in there than the second one. So it might be they're getting more than they expect, you know, if they're just taking it in a similar manner. Yeah. Other than that, I'm not sure. Other questions?
Would you be open to sharing the recipe for the pecan?
Bitters.
Yeah,
I can, but you're going to have to email me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This concludes the class. For more information about the Commonwealth Center for Holistic Herbalism, visit our website at commonwealthherbs.com.